Welcome to the Sanctum. Here we study the mysteries of Dungeon Crawl Classics and Appendix N. With your keepers of mysteries, Jen Brinkman, Mark Bruner, Bob Brinkman. Enter the Sanctum Sanctorum and be inspired.
Welcome to the Sanctum Sanctorum podcast, where we plumb the depths of Appendix N as it pertains to the Dungeon Crawl Classics role-playing game. We're here to help you serve these literary offerings at your DCC RPG table. I'm Keeper Mark, and with me tonight are Keeper Jen.
Hello, everyone.
And Keeper Bob.
Hey, folks, how you doing?
Tonight, we explore the solar system with the exciting inaugural volume of the final series imagined and penned by Edgar Rice Burroughs, The Pirates of Venus. Bob, do you want to give us a synopsis?
Sure thing. The shimmering cloud-covered planet of Venus conceals a wonderful secret, the strikingly beautiful yet deadly world of Amtor. In Amtor, cities of immortal beings flourish in giant trees reaching thousands of feet into the sky. Ferocious beasts stalk the wilderness below. Rare flashes of sunlight precipitate devastating storms. And the inhabitants believe their world is saucer-shaped, with a fiery center and an icy rim. Stranded on Amtor after his spaceship crashes, astronaut Carson Napier is swept into a world where revolution is ripe, the love of a princess carries a dear price, and death can come as easily from the blade of a sword as from the ray of a futuristic gun.
Okay, I will say this one was kind of fun, but it was also kind of, oh, shall we say, derivative? Is that the right word?
Repetitive of other works that Edgar Rice Burroughs, and it's specifically the one we just did, like, you know, four or five episodes ago, the At the Earth's Core or Journey to the Center, you know, the one, it has a lot of the same themes.
Well, I mean, this is set in the same universe as the Pellucidar series and takes place after book four, Tarzan and Earth's Core. So those similarities are okay. But let's just go straight to the elephant in the room. I was having a really great time, and then I was very uncomfortable that the Soldiers of Liberty initials in Amtor were KKK, and the main character talks about how tickled he is, you know, that the initials are the same as that famed secret organization. That really bugged me quite a bit.
Yeah, it jarred you out of the story.
It jarred you out. These are the good guys. Are they really the good guys? I mean, they're fighting Venusian communists. I guess they're supposed to be the good guys, but
they do have the skulls on their caps. They are the baddies.
Yeah, you know, I mean, just, you know, I mean, John Carter of Mars is a Confederate veteran, and this guy is a fan of the KKK. Other than that,
we're villainizing the dark-skinned people already in this book. By we, I mean Burroughs. I guess this is from the 30s, right? Is it too late to say, oh, it's a product of its time, or are we still dead on the nose there?
The KKK was very active until the 60s, 70s. I mean, we had elected officials, you know.
In the 1930s, in like Illinois, you didn't become governor without the backing of the KKK. The KKK was a very powerful organization at the time.
Scary.
It was certainly not the mainstream view at all, right?
In terms of,
but
it carried a lot of clout.
Yeah.
And I mean, yeah, so this was serialized in 32 and published in 34. Now we've gotten the Klan out of the way, right? It comes up once. It comes up once and once only. I mean, we have Burroughs's particular prejudices based on skin color, as we've seen before. But beyond those things that we were already aware of, KKK was startling. But the book itself is interesting and strange at the same time, right? I mean, you look at when this was written. It was written 30 years after the film From the Earth to the Moon, you know, the famous rocket plunging into the moon, first science fiction film. 29 years after the idea of using rockets to reach outer space was proposed by Russian mathematician Konstantin Tsiolkovsky. 10 years after the creation of the Society for Studies of Interplanetary Travel by the same Russian mathematician. And 6 years after what is considered the beginning of the true space age. So the whole rocketry into space is very timely for its period. And some of the rocketry facts are correct, right? I mean, he's got escape velocity down. That's really when he's talking about, I've got to get to this many miles per second. He's not kidding. That the math checks out. It's accurate.
You know, part of those details got a little bit cumbersome, but at the same time, I was remembering the very similar voyage in At the Earth's Core, where they're in a big rocket, but they're tunneling into the Earth instead of going off into space. But I will say that the fact that he misses Mars and ends up on Venus, it was probably the best bit of suspense in the book.
I absolutely loved the fact that they just forgot to account for the moon when he launched.
Yeah.
Threw him off course. I did enjoy that. Yeah, now, granted, based on the first chapter, you can tell he was definitely paid by the word when this was being serialized, right? I mean,
well, so when you're reading the intro, I had to laugh when you said astronaut, because this guy, he's a playboy, he's like a psychic, he's like a swordsman, he's the typical sort of, you know, hero of the Tarzan slash, you know, the journey at the Earth's core, you know, protagonist, right? He's got all these kind of skills that are very much utility in all these situations. But let's talk about the wild intro to this, where it's not quite a bookend, because I don't know where it ends, right? You know, but it's basically like 10 pages of, he writes a letter to an author. The author's the one perspective we have. And he just comes in and says, oh, by the way, I gained my psychic powers from a guru in India, and I can transmit my thoughts across space, and I'm going to do that for this journey that I'm proposing. And that's the explanation, right?
It's not just that. The entire purpose of chapter one, why I get to write in first person. Really, because, let's face it, I'm psychic, I project thoughts, but only in chapter one. Not in any of the subsequent chapters am I psychic, only in chapter one.
Yeah, and then in the standing back and thinking that this is like, the author is getting this message from Carson, right, and he's recording it somehow, right, this is like, you know, where, it'd be interesting to read the other books just for this sort of like, does this ever come back again, right? Is there any kind of like, you know, use of this technique? Because that's actually, it's kind of interesting, but it's not, it's never again in the book, right? Like you said, Bob, it's just this kind of weird way of introducing, you know, the narrative. You know, he has to have a way of, you know, connecting back to Earth without being able to do that through a scientific means. He's lost his rocket, you know, all these kind of things. But I just thought it was wild. Was not expecting it, you know, and maybe I should have from, you know, some of the other Burroughs, you know, books, but
It is a common trope for the time, especially for authors like Burroughs that wrote in first person, right? When he did The Land That Time Forgot, which involved, like, you know, a submarine and dinosaurs, the entire story is found in a letter in a bottle. Which,
that's
of course,
a big bottle.
Yeah, it's a very large bottle. And and really, if you think about reading that particular book, skip it and watch the movie, because the screenplay was done by Michael Moorcock, right? So it's going to be tightened up a bit. But yeah, I learned telepathy from my Hindu mystic tutor when I was a child. Seriously, that's what we're going to go with.
It did somewhat remind me of Jack Williamson and the Legion of Space, because we had that other odd sort of, you know, the future history, you know, introduction to that. And so both of those are very, like, intriguing in some ways. They're very, you know, you scoff at them, but they're very much in that sort of like fantasy pushing the boundaries of fantasy, you know, and at the time. And it has, it does have that kind of quirky sort of like, well, let's just get right to the adventure, right? So let's just come up with a, you know, an explanation that, yeah, everybody can just accept and go on with and not even, never, never mention again.
Wait, let's get right to the adventure after a chapter of explaining to you how we're going to be able to get to the adventure. And you're right, Jack Williamson uses it. It was a very common trope in like early science fiction and science fantasy. The worm Ouroboros starts with, you know, the protagonist walking into a royal party in a castle on Venus, and then is never mentioned again. There doesn't even seem to be as much purpose as there is here for that chapter. So yeah, it's
that's like the beginning of a lot of games, right? So you walk into a pub. you walk into the situation. Here you go.
I'm actually coming around to it a little bit after, you know, when I read the novel, I was thinking, you know, this is really not bringing me much more than what I've already read with Burroughs or, you know, some of the authors. It's, you know, I don't really feel a strong attachment to Carson, right? He's kind of this, you know, every man who can do everything, right? You know, he's
the nth degree.
To the nth degree, yeah, and he's extraordinarily strong. He's the best swimmer. He's trained in German sword fighting, but he's not as good at these sword fighters, but he can still overcome them right through these, you know.
Well, and he's extraordinarily strong for the same reason that John Carter was, because right. Lesser gravity, right? Just like the John Carter series kind of starts retreading itself. It's really, I think it's 9 books in the series, but it's 5 stories really, and they just repeat. This is definitely derivative of his earlier works. You are right.
Although I find myself wondering at the end of each chapter, where was this cut off for the purposes of serialization?
Yeah.
Yeah, because it was over 6 months.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious too, because like, where are the cliffhanger moments throughout the story, right?
But it was a 9-part serial in the British weekly, The Passing Show, which started the year after that. And still prior to it being published in book form in 34.
Well, that might be then we went from 6 parts to reorganizing it to 9 chapters.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of hard to tell. I mean, and can we talk about the flat Venusians for a minute? Because their theories are as frustrating as those of flat earthers. And I felt for Carson when he stated that there's no use arguing with a man who can multiply anything by the square root of -1. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, you know, that's a conspiracy theorist, all right. You know, where they're like, well, you know, obviously it doesn't matter that the circle seems larger than the circle inside of it. They're all just 1,000 degrees around. And since they're 1,000 degrees around,
you all agree.
You know, then, you know, a degree is a degree, so there's no difference of measure. What? Well, see, you have to, the discrepancy comes until you multiply it by the square root of -1.
Yeah, it is interesting. Like, the presentation is one of the kind of aspects that was a little bit more intriguing, where you have this kind of closed off society, right? They don't have any point of reference for space, stars, planets.
Yep.
And I kind of wish that was actually followed through a little bit more, because it would make it feel a little bit more unique in the setting versus, well, they're just humans with tans and, you know, forever lives, right? Everything is just sort of like, you know, once you get into the world, everything is just very much like a blue, you know, cut a part of Earth culture transplanted to Venus was just kind of the surface etching of something different. There's not really a lot that makes the culture distinct or unique, but those things, like not having any kind of concept of, you know, space, could really be, you know, a fun thing to explore a little bit more.
As opposed to just, this is where Bob smells burning toast, because that's how I felt when I was reading those arguments.
It's almost as irritating as the way the new language was explained to him. You know, we're not going to discuss it in detail, but here's the syntax of how you would append something if it's plural or masculine or feminine.
Wait, wait, wait. You two language geeks didn't go nuts for that part of the book? Because I really thought you'd go nuts for that part of the book.
I would have if it wasn't prefaced with, but I won't bore you with the fine details. Are you kidding? Well, this coming from the same guy that was, you know, just a hero in and of himself, because nobody had ever seen a blonde and blue-eyed guy. Hmm. So everyone's going crazy for his blonde hair. And
so that's kind of funny. Because now this is, like I said, this is 32. Post World War II, when you know you had GIs in Japan, they were kind of viewed the very same way, right? These light skinned, blonde haired people was very, very strange. I thought that was actually kind of prescient the way people responded, just based on how I know people here on Earth really did respond within 15, 20 years. So that whole, whoa, you're strange, and wanting to touch his hair and things like that are real things.
I mean, I get that, but he's also just inherently...
Well, he focuses a lot on, I'm blonde with blue eyes, and thus I am the heroic archetype. Yeah.
Ew. Yeah.
There is that.
Yeah.
The savior, the person who can lead the revolution, right? You know, he's just sort of like the natural commander, leader, even though, it is this kind of like class system, obviously, that, you know, it's very much a critique of communism at the time. That is a heavy-handed, part of the narrative.
Yeah, the Thorists are the communists. We get it.
But he takes it to this kind of extreme of the Thorists are ignorant and slow and stupid and degenerate. And, of course, you know, the Vespians, I can't remember the pronunciations, but, you know, they're the intellectual class that, you know, had to flee and were persecuted. And, you know, they're the only ones that can really understand the technology, even though the Thorists have, you know, acquired all the leftover technology that was developed by this, you know, hugely successful culture that was part of this thing. But it's very much like, you know, it gets into this class strata that's just, it was hard to like really enjoy those aspects of the novel because it was just so heavy-handed.
I thought there was something that I found very interesting. And they're talking about, you know, the Thorists are very obviously, you know, Russian communists, right? But then the society that we're rooting for, which is certainly more intellectual, is what? Socialist? Because while you have to work, you just work at what you're best at and you just do what you do, right? And it's just that everyone has to take part. And, the servants of essentially their king are, you know, it's a place of honor. They rotate through. Oh, there are slaves, but they choose their masters. Their masters look after them. It was very strange. You could not say that this was capitalism versus communism. I think it was more of a denunciation of communism versus like intellectual socialism. It was very strange in that. And I found it pretty interesting.
Interesting is a heavy word for that, but yeah, there were some interesting ideas put forth. I think the imagery would probably win over the story for me. The story and most of the details. I did dig the piratical slant to a point, but
it's so late in the book.
Yeah, that, and it's so, oh, look at me, I'm a captain now.
A better title for this, they're calling it Pirates of Venus, but really this is more falling down a tree on Venus and a small bit of being a pirate, right? I mean, that's kind of how this goes. I was really happy to see, though, and it's a particular pet peeve of mine, where I'm constantly seeing spears described as thrown weapons, or they're not. Spears are thrusting weapons. You throw javelins, you poke with spears. And, the Venusians are like, this is a spear. And he's like, it's a short, heavy javelin. I'm like, thank you. So that I felt good about that.
Now, all this said, I will say I'd be interested to see a first edition of this. Not only does it include a glossary of the Amtor terms, but it contains a map of Amtor that burrows through.
I would be really interested to see that.
Yeah.
That would be an interesting bit of ephemera. Yeah.
Probably can't afford one, but actually probably can't afford a signed one. Early burrows,
I said I'm interested,
aren't to really expensive unless he signed
not
them.
Own it. Caveat,
oh,
Bob.
I don't know if we have it for our library.
But this is also probably one, I mean, from what I read, a more minor series of Burroughs, like probably the least known, right, in many ways, because it was his last series. You know, it was one of those things that, you know, was probably, you know, from my perspective, at least it's, you know, people probably said, well, this is John Carter on Venus, right? Or this is, you know, Tarzan in space, you know, that. And so I think that that's probably, you know, it may be more achievable to get your hands on something like that.
Well, and you're not kidding when you say it's John Carter on Venus. When I was like, oh, okay, I wanted to look up some details on Wiki, and I kept looking up John Carson. I mean, because this really is. I mean, just like I said, John Carter gets derivative. This starts derivative.
Yeah.
And for all of his "I am the hero," Carson seemed like so many of Burroughs's characters completely oblivious when someone is plotting treachery.
Oh yeah.
Well, that's really obvious. Could you be a little more heavy handed? Could he, like, I don't know, you know, have a sinister mustache that he twirls before he stabs you in the back? And that is another constant in Burroughs' works is, no hero's perfect. They all seem to have the same blind spot. But, I mean,
that's what happens when it's a first-person point of view.
Right? I mean, overall, like I said, once I'm kind of past the problematic portions of Burroughs and the stunner that came later in the book, other than that, it was entertaining. It took, I don't know, it took like an hour and a half to read, right? I mean, the audiobook for this thing is 6 hours long. If someone reading this to you out loud is 6 hours, you know this is a quick read. So I didn't feel that I wasted the time that I had spent in reading it. It just perhaps wasn't, especially after Jack Williamson's Legion of Space, this was kind of a letdown.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the key point for me is that we've seen this before, right? And so that was part of me, you know, reacting this in a, you know, it was less enjoyable just from that perspective, right? We've seen a better Burroughs book, in my opinion. But Legion of Space is actually, you know, one of the things that surprised me for how much I ended up enjoying it after getting past that initial, you know, first, you know, the initial chapter. So
chapter of this is how I get to tell you the story.
Yeah, but because it is that sort of sense of this is a group of adventurers, this is very much, you know, the template of the Three Musketeers, you know, that they're taking that. This is not, that never really had this cohesiveness for me because in many ways his companions are isolated from him for large parts of the narrative. He's very much acting like an individual, you know, throughout the series or throughout the book. Even at the end, you know, he's shipped off, presumably captive to the next series of adventures, but he doesn't have, other than just sort of like lieutenants, you know, that he kind of call, you know, gets at the end. There's no real deeper relationship there.
And who writes book one and gives it the Empire Strikes Back ending? Right? I mean,
why is this like the stopping point for book one versus, you know, bringing forward some more?
There's more, right? I mean, this is not the ending of a story. Oh, she is freed, and I am now in chains. Really? What? Wait, that's the end.
But yeah, like you said, Bob, I think this is something that is a very quick read, you know. And if you are a fan of just that science blend of science fiction and fantasy, because you do see that in the series or this book, you know, you have the sword fighting, the sort of primitive weapons, the javelins, contrasted with these, you know, science-based, you know, extra or R rays and T rays, and the weird sort of movements the ships do that are controlled by decaying elements, and, you know, so all these things are. It's kind of that if you enjoy that sort of genre, this is a, you know, it's a easy read. It's kind of fun for that aspect. I would suggest reading some of the other Burroughs books.
Edgar Rice Burroughs wrote some great books. This is not one of them. This is good. It's entertaining, but.
And that's okay. We don't have to like every single one of these.
Yeah. You get what you get with this. It's not awful.
But yeah, don't go into it for, without warning about the triggers, you know.
I'm like, seriously? I'm like, no, that's, you can't. And then he's like, yeah, that's secret. I'm like, oh no. Oh God. Yeah, that was rather disappointing.
And they give you just enough language so that you can actually understand what he's saying.
But he didn't he also come up with the name? So he was sort of the person who created the name, that created the sound.
Yeah, Soldiers of Liberty. Yeah, which, I mean, if you think about it, he knew right off the bat. I didn't think about that, Mark, but you're right, because he named it Soldiers of Liberty, but he named it in their language, so he knew what he
would have
known,
yeah.
Oh, now I like Carson even less. Carson's kind of a racist dick.
What were they chanting in the background, Bob?
Oh, wow, that's just... And the whole, I don't know, calling it Pirates of Venus, the sailing section, while interesting...
It's not very good, you know. It's not. There are a lot more high sea adventure stories.
It paints a like high seas adventure kind of story with the title, and it doesn't really deliver.
I agree.
The scenes of swashbuckling are okay, and so in a paragraph, I've defeated this person, and in two other paragraphs, the ship was taken. Really, that's
At that point, it's much more about the.
Maybe this was meant for a visual medium.
The audiobook was more drawn out than that, so it was longer than two paragraphs.
Oh, well, there you go. And I forget which studio it is. Some studio has licensed the entire Venus series from the Burroughs estate for films. They've got the license for it. It was like, I think it was originally licensed by one studio in like 2002, and then those rights lapsed, and now they're held by another studio. And, you know, in a visual medium with the way Hollywood interferes with script writing, it could be something really good.
Well, I think people will also be looking at the John Carter film and saying, we can't try that again.
There are rumors that John Carter might finally get a Disney Plus series to follow up the first movie. The first movie was fantastic, but the marketing was terrible. That's what killed
it. Yeah, and I think that's where, you know, it was seen as a failure or a flop, and it didn't make back, you know, it's
yeah, it's they would definitely have to really hype this up and not just have a picture of a red sun with John Carter as the title. It really didn't sell people.
Google?
So.
Sorry. You say red sun, my brain goes elsewhere.
I would love to see, instead of, you know, John Carter, I would love to see like a Lee Brackett, Hounds of Skate.
Oh, I would love to see Lee Brackett on the big screen. Most definitely. Most definitely. We digress to better books.
Yeah, so yeah, if it wasn't a great read necessarily, did it inspire us in terms of things to bring to the gaming table?
There's a few things that that really kind of piqued my interest. The energy weapons, the R ray and the T ray, which both of which are powered by elements that are now known to exist, but at the time were just theoretical. And so I kind of dug that. He's like, all right, so this is powered by 96 and 103. And the way they're separated by a thin, you know, piece of metal, and pulling the trigger essentially lifts that divider and lets out this energy beam. I really kind of dug the way that worked. I liked the in-world science for it. And how, of course, you know, the Thoris don't know how to make more of these because they, you know, they killed off and drove off everyone that knew how. But, you know, the R ray only affects flesh. The T ray pretty much kills everything. I mean, one's like a microwave emitter and the other is a disintegration beam.
And I really liked the idea of, as you use it, it destroys the mechanism that's firing it. Like the cannons on the ship, you know, they say, they deteriorate by the same, you know, process because they're in contact with this ray. And I kind of like that idea for a weapon that every time you use it, there's a chance that it, you know, doesn't work anymore, right?
Don't roll,
you know,
that's a
fun concept.
That's
true. Yeah, but it's kind of this assured thing, right? It's going to break down.
It's slowly, and I like, but you know, It's slowly eating it away because the majority of it goes straight out the barrel because that's the direction it's going. I'm like, all right, all of that made sense. And then when they're like, oh, why haven't we destroyed their ship by accident by this point? Oh, because the ships are lined with that same metal to prevent just such an occurrence. And they're like, well, that makes perfect sense. If they hadn't had that, I would have been scratching my head. So you've got this metal that you put in the guns to protect you from the guns and to make sure they don't go off by accident. And so you've got this, and you don't put a thin layer of this on your ship so that you could just destroy them. So I liked that little detail, which then prevented the whole thing from being over too quickly, although, you know, it all was written very quickly, but I liked the way that worked out. So I enjoyed the R ray and the T ray, and I mean, their engines worked in a very similar fashion. Then there was the Targo, the giant spider that screams to paralyze its prey. Like, you know, people that have, even people that don't have a problem with a spider, you would probably have a problem with a giant spider. And they would definitely have a problem with a giant spider that rushes at you while shrieking at the top of its lungs. Mm-hmm. I was like, that is such a creepy, creepy detail. I love that. And then the second time we see one, it's not screaming because he's already tangled in the web. So it's definitely just a, I will frighten you and paralyze you. And
yeah, that would have been right at home in Queen of the Demon Web Pits.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, yes. And I liked the Klangen. The Klangen was the plural. I think it was the Angen was the singular. But the birdmen, the feathered men with bat wings, which was a little strange, but they were kind of neat. They were certainly very simple creatures, to the point where, well, you know, if you kill their master, then you're their master, and they'll just do whatever you want because that's just the way they are. And you know, that paints a few, you know, pictures as well. But when we first encounter them, when they're flying overhead and they've got ropes that go down to wire nooses, mm-hmm. and they're dropping those around people to pick them up and haul them up, and the swords are useless because they can't reach the rope, they're only hitting the wire. I was like, that's really clever and really creepy, and I really enjoyed them. And having done a D&D adventure with bird people, maybe I'm more fond of the Klangen than other folks might be, but I really dug them.
Well, they seem to have a little bit of personality too, right? They're I think talked about as, you know, they usually are very, you know, talkative. They, you know, they can't, you know, stop, you know, with their expressions and things like that until one of them is like, I'm not talking because, you know, you're going to take me back and then you're going to kill me. And, you know, it's, but, you know, I think that they have that kind of like, they're represented a little bit more interesting for than the other creatures and or the other people, at least, right? You know, the other people are just really just villains or, you know, good guys.
So. Well, and when they're in a group, I kind of imagine them as, you know, when you go to a pet store and you walk up to all the cockatiels in the cage, right? Right. All just kind of you know chittering and tweeting and singing. Well, that's what these things do when left to their own devices. And after the, no, I'm not going to kill you, he's like, oh, and then he forgets all about it. And he's just whistling and singing and happy again.
Well, and the fact that they brought their captives to the boat, and then you forget about them. And then it's like revealed that they're still in the boat, just hanging out, just waiting for the next thing to have to entertain them or command
them. Someone threw a sheet over their cage and they're off screen until needed again.
Are you kidding? They're the perfect ones to work in the crow's nest. No intended, but they wouldn't have to climb the rigging to get up there.
Well, that's fair.
That's actually how they took out the lookout.
Yep, they stuck the guy in the back with a sword. So, but those are the things that really kind of captured my attention. What about you, Mark? What tickled your fancy?
Yeah, I think the monsters, the one that was interesting, you know, was the one you mentioned, the Targo. There are a few others that are depicted in the stories, but they're not really that key to the plot. They're just sort of, you know, described once and thrown away. The one of them that was the Basto, which is this bison-like creature that's, you know, hunched forward on its, you know, its four legs, and it's carrying its weight there, and it's, you know, killed by, you know, one of the patients who's very skilled at it, because he, you know, he tells Carson, you'll just get in the way, and he comes and, you know, kills it through the side or with the blow of the sword. You might stat that up as sort of like an alternative, you know, herbivore type creature that's, you know, kind of, you know, putting some strangeness in there, but it wasn't that evocative. But I certainly listed there as another creature that was maybe a little bit more described than some of the other ones that are, you know, just alluded to. I did like the idea of the serum of longevity, right? You know, this concept that the patients are scientifically advanced enough to have invented this process where they can cure disease and aging and get rid of all your, I guess, your micro gut bacteria. but they have to like keep this routine of every 2 years getting a new injection, right? And they're losing the medical knowledge that they used to be pervasive in their society. You know, I think the Durnus, you know, was the, you know, saying that there are very few that can actually pass the test to become doctors these days because, you know, only like 2% of the people, you know, that were doctors could now be them. And so this idea that, you know, the civilization, you know, created this, they still have some people with the knowledge of it, but you can imagine a future where, you know, that knowledge is lost or becomes precious or fought over. And this resource is, you know, how do you solve that? Right. And so the idea that you could inject something like that into a game, maybe it's already taken to the point of, you know, nobody can create this thing again. You know, how do you go about, you know, using it, you know, as an adventurer? Or, you know, is this something that you quest after, right? You know, you try to find, you know, the source for this and recreate it. But I did like that idea of like, it's not like you inject it once and you're cured.
It's not one and done. Yeah.
Yeah. You have to have this regimen of like, you know, redosing yourself, which I thought was kind of a cool concept. So there was that.
I like that instead of an instant fix.
Yeah. There was this idea of the Torque, which was just a game that's like a throwaway, but it's like one of these things that, you know, we've done this with Vance before where you have a throwaway line and you just like, you can create whatever you want out of it. But it was described as a combination of Mahjong and poker, right? You know, so this kind of idea that's a betting game with, you know, these kind of tiles and symbols. I think it was just like, you know, one brief reference to that, that the patients, you know, play this game. And I think you could, you know, like you did, Bob, for the Dying Earth series, you know, with Skax and some of these other things, you know, it's kind of fun to imagine creating a game that is part of this world that's, you know, takes this inspiration. And I think you could work something like that, you know, inspired by Pirates of Venus. You have a new, you know, game.
Now I want to read the rest of the series just to see if we get more information on Torque.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe it does come up again. Yeah, in here is just like a throwaway line. So, but yeah, there wasn't a lot else. You know, I know that the Targos do weave this, you know, very strong fiber that's, you know, can support the weight of many men. You know, I think that's one time comment on, or they weave it into, they use it to weave their clothes out of, right? And so I think it's very similar to some other, you know, this is a super strong fiber type thing, but, you know, they call it the Tarl. I did like the, you know, we're going out and collecting Tarl, and Carson, of course, is, you know, completely ignorant and doesn't, you know, ask the questions that would be, but sort of obviously makes these assumptions that we're going to go and gather from the bushes, you know, this fiber. And it turns out, no, we have to go hunt the spiders. It does create the sort of, you know, a little bit of fun there.
Yeah, that was kind of a neat scene.
But there's not a lot that's new there compared to like, you know, you could come up with a lot of different ways of having the strong fiber. The fact that it just come from a spider, you know, is kind of interesting. You know, that would be kind of a fun thing to weave into, pun intended, your stories, you know, having to go and find the fiber from this, you know, creature and then it lets you, you know, have stronger rope or things
like that. Yeah, that was neat.
That was about it. I don't know. Yeah, there wasn't a whole lot that I found here that was, you know, really intriguing. I did like Torque. I did like, you know, the Serum of Longevity. I think those are things that are worth exploring. What about you, Jen?
Well, Bob pretty much covered the ship's guns. I was intrigued by the mention of their motors. There was nothing given as to what propelled them. They didn't tell you if it was like a steam engine or, you know, little Yamaha engine in the back or something.
What was the energy that was being produced actually doing to force the ships along?
Right. The method of propellant would have been interesting to know. I was really fascinated by the atmospheric mist because it is so thick that it totally obfuscates the rest of everything beyond their little world. And just the isolation aspect of it reminded me a lot of Metamorphosis Alpha. Because you don't know what you're going to from one region to the next. And I started thinking, who or what caused that? Like, is that a residual effect from something? Or is it placed there on purpose?
That's a really good question.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you know, scientifically, we know why Venus is covered in clouds the way it is, but in the 1930s, the idea of runaway greenhouse gases would not be among things they would likely consider. So what did cause it, right? Is it something like, well, is it something like Barsoom, right? Where there's an ancient race that has a machine and they use it for control. That's,
Do they have active residents at their core, right? I don't know. This being recorded.
Both of you are raising questions are going to make me read the rest of this series. I'm not excited about that.
But if it's only an hour and a half per book.
Well, that's fair. I suppose it's a day to get to the bottom of these questions.
Project Gutenberg, grab them. But this being recorded the day after the big eclipse, I really got to thinking about that obfuscation. And to be honest, the arboreal city setting that they were in at the beginning, to me, that was more fascinating than the ship. Because this was unknown vegetation that may or may not work with you. The creatures in it, the dwellings in it, the sheer height, and the acrobatic abilities that have to be ingrained in generation after generation of people living there. So I kind of went the nerd route on that one. I'm focusing more on the world building than the little aspects within it, like the guns.
Yeah, and it's too bad that that's not really the focus. Yeah,
it's also one of the few areas where he gets into some cool descriptions, where he's talking about, you know, the carvings around the door, this massive, you know, historic scene. And, you know, the border's kind of mundane, but everything else. And so there's a lot of detail. You know, the tree is 300 paces around and they're thousands of feet tall. It's like the arboreal city is really all that Edgar Rice Burroughs cared about.
Yeah, because once you get to the surface, it's pretty much like Earth, right? You know, there's not a lot. There's seas, there's rolling hills.
There's just big trees to walk around, yeah.
I wish it had been explored more of a focus. And the half the book is really just, you know, this kind of side buccaneers, pirates, you know.
How many books are in the series?
I want to say six.
Might have to do that as well. Anyway, that's my dorky little list.
Well, what about props and audio suggestions? Anything there, Jen?
There was someone who grabbed a tree frond to distract the basto, the buffalo bison thing.
Right, right.
Prior to hitting it with their spear, not javelin. So just having that there as kind of a distraction technique, you know, offer it up to the players.
Maybe the players are the pesky bastos. Maybe just smack them with a palm frond.
That too. That and, you know, everyone was reduced to loincloths. So just kind of keep that out on the table as a reminder.
No one would ever play my Venus game.
Oh, boy. Sorry I said that. What about you, Mark?
I like the loincloths. I was thinking, you know, it'd be kind of fun because the arboreal stuff is the most sort of like, you know, unique element of the terrain. You know, this is, I was thinking about, you know, calling out, well, maybe you could just take your game outside and do it in a jungle setting. But I didn't think that was like a good advice, you know, from a fun thing for your players to do. So I didn't really have so much for props, but, you know, I know Bob's going to cover, you know, what he was able to find, you know, the limited selection of things that I think, you know, were inspired as far as music. But this really is one of those settings that, because it has like an arboreal feel, it has an ocean feel, it has, you know, this sort of space, you know, that go, you know, that you go through in the clouds and the and sort of the different atmospheres. I think this is really something that I would try to just have atmospheric sound effects, you know, going on, because, you know, you'd have like a jungle, you know, background, you know, with, you know, animals and birds and insects, and the ocean, just like waves and things like that. So for me, that was sort of what I was thinking in terms of like how you draw out some of the elements of the story, is you have these different locations, especially like if you can imagine hurtling through space through this, you know, dense Venus atmosphere, and sort of the rushing, you know, sounds, and trying to build up that tension of, you know, what happens when the rocket enters this. You know, Carson is thinking, he's a goner, but he ends up, you know, with this kind of weird world that he gets deposited on. So that was kind of my thought, is that, you know, the ambient sounds would be kind of a fun thing to incorporate if you're exploring this world. I'm not sure why this story more than others kind of evoked that, but I think that was what inspired me, at least.
You have these settings, right? It's almost like each installment of Argosy was in each of these settings.
Mm-hmm.
So that would track.
All right, Bob, what were you able to pull together?
Oh, first of all, I think if I was going to go with a prop, knowing how they can howl and scream when they get excited, the idea of putting a husky in a spider costume and turning it loose on your players. You know, that there's my prop idea for you. Nice. And it was kind of tough finding music for this one. I really, you know, we've done Edgar Rice Burroughs recently, and this one doesn't really have as much that is musically evocative, right? I mean, Pellucidar, there's actually native drumming and things of that nature. But I started thinking, and my kicking off point was a soundtrack by Alain Gouraguer, which is the La Planète Sauvage, or Fantastic Planet soundtrack.
Yes, brilliant, yeah.
Brilliant movie, really cool soundtrack. I paired that up with his Faust, the Lost Recordings from 1971 to 78, as kind of my launching point for music here. Then I went to one of my favorites, or one of my favorite musicians, Jean-Michel Jarre. Roger? Okay, he's my favorite, but I can't necessarily pronounce his last name. but he has an album, Planet Jarre, which is sort of a best of. And I mean, none of his pieces are short. I mean, like one of his songs will be 15 minutes or more. And it's absolutely fantastic stuff. From there, kind of keeping in the in almost like the dreamlike strange music trend, I pulled up two albums by Alejandro Jodorowsky, who is probably best known for the Dune movie that never was. But I started with his The Holy Mountain soundtrack, and then his Ambient Moods album, which goes from strange to ambience and lighter music, which oddly enough, the last track of Ambient Moods flows really well into the last two albums I put in there, because I wanted to kind of kickstart my heart and get things moving again. So I ended the this year or this month's playlist with two albums by Glory Hammer. The first is Space 1992, Rise of the Chaos Wizards. And the second is Legends from Beyond the Galactic Terror Vortex. And both of those albums are wholly unlike everything that comes before. But just the way Ambient Moods blends into Space 1992, I didn't find it too jarring. And it was it was kind of, I thought it was a cool juxtaposition, but also it was, it captured the feel of the stories for me in a higher octane music form, if that makes sense. So most of the stuff is kind of, you know, laid back and, you know, electronica or kind of drifting and strange. And then there's that razor focus from Glory Hammer. And that is, yeah, the playlist, which will go into the show notes. It's 4 hours of music. So if you don't like any part of it, there's still plenty left when you skip past. But I think that brings us to Keeper Mark's words of the day.
Well, there's always some interesting words in Burroughs, and I called out a few that I hadn't heard or seen before, except for one of them, but he uses the term chela, which is describing these prehensile claws that are, I don't think they're on the torgo, I think they're on a different beast. And they mean basically the prehensile claws of crabs, lobsters, and, you know, I love that word sounds just very, you know, menacing of itself. So that was a nice word.
I had to look that one up.
Asininity. It's hard to pronounce.
Yeah, that one.
But basically, at some point, you know, Carson's like, "Oh, I was so stupid for, you know, approaching the princess," you know, and he's like, "I made a," you know, he uses this term, asininity, which is like an asinine quality or stupidity. I think at one point he's talking about, you know, he prefers the term buccaneers to pirates because it has a haut ton characteristic, and that means, you know, high fashion. It's a little bit more, I think of his, he thinks of himself rather than a pirate is more of a Robin Hood of the seas type figure. And so I thought that was a nice word. And then Philip, which is something I had never heard before, but he's describing himself like as the ocean flicking him onto the shore with, the, you know, they saved from the rock. So he says, "In one last flip, you know, I was, you know, carried onto the shore." And that's basically like the you know, the motion of a finger, you know, flicking outward and then releasing it, right? So that tension. So I like that, you know, that image of him being sort of like flung by the ocean, like a finger flicking, you know, off of the thumb. And that was another word that I like to call out. So those four are just, you know, ones that, you know, I found really intriguing, and I don't think I'd have come across very many of them before. So,
Mark, where's my OEDs?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'll put that in the notes so that I can get the bands, the frequency bands. Yeah,
I really dug Philip because much like aglet, right? An aglet is a thing, you look at it, you know it exists, but you have no idea if there's a name for it or not. And, you know, Philip, it really is. It's, you know, putting your finger to your thumb and flicking something, you know, just, you know, coming up and thwacking someone in the ear.
Yeah.
There is a name for it. Never knew.
And just the fact that it's used in a way that's not directly the definition, right? He's using it in this, you know, evocative way where the ocean is the finger. And that's the kind of fun stuff that you can get from Burroughs occasionally. So, the book's worth reading just for that. All right. Well, let's take us to reskins of existing DCC works. And Jen, do you want to start off again with this?
I sure can. I mentioned that I did get more of a Metamorphosis Alpha vibe. That's not cheating because Goodman Games did still publish some of my stuff, but as far as existing adventures, I would recommend the Tribe of Og and the Trials of Moss. That can be found in the Sanctum Sequorum episode 41 companion. Some guy named Bob, I don't know. But it bridges that MA into MCC groove. And I really dig that. I don't know why this guy Bob was on my brain, but I'm thinking if you want these nautical touches in your game, pull Crawl Zine issue 11 and Skull and Crossbones Classics, and you'll be a damn sight more accurate. For actual thematic similarities, I think that Stephen Newton's Children of the Fallen Sun really blends the fish out of water and the religious and even anarchist fanaticism really well. So that's I'm keeping it short and sweet this time because I could go on, but I feel like I'm always calling out the same things. I mean, there are unique aspects to this one, so make sure to point those out. What about you, Mark?
I kind of like your Metamorphosis Alpha tie-in. This is something that just screamed MCC to me in many ways, with the different regions, you know, the Hothouse Jungle being this, you know, very much similar to the Venusian, you know, jungles and arbors that, you know, the cities that are there. And you can imagine like a tribe of filled with seekers that are going out to explore and, you know, finding different terrains, because, you know, the MCC world is, it has a lot of the sort of like, well, there's a sea, there's also, you know, areas that you can't go to because they're forbidden in some ways, whether it's, you know, radioactivity or controlled by, you know, Thorist in that case. So I think you could use MCC in general as a setting for a Venusian adventures in the Pirates of Venus style. The two adventures that I wanted to call out, and, you know, I was also trying to find things that I hadn't really promoted before necessarily, but if you're a fan of Crawljammer and Tim Callahan's work, there is a adventure that was published as in a zine format, I think, called Demon Drums. And it is set in a swamp setting, and there is a haunted tree, an enormous haunted tree that is very much a, you know, you could use one of these giant trees that are, you know, part of the, you know, the Vespasians homes. And it just made me think of that, right? You could reskin that to, you know, to be on Venus and, you know, kind of populated with some of the creatures that we talked about. Crawljammer is also just great, you know, for this sort of, you know, intersection of fantasy and science fiction. The other one I was going to call it is just because I instantly was thinking this when the Klangen were described, was the Gorhellas in Michael Curtis's A Miracle Was Framed, where the first part of that adventure is basically these winged gorillas, you know, flying down and trying to, you know, capture or assault the adventurers. And so I really liked the idea that, you know, these Klangens, you know, are, you know, essentially like that type of creature, and you could have a Miracles, you know, be the Thorist, right? You know, or that kind of setting. So I think that's a fun adventure, one of the early Goodman Games products for the DCC RPG line, you know, and so Gorhellas, you know, are just a great concept and great, you know, name for a monster, but you could certainly make them Klangen equivalents in your Pirates of Venus reskinning. But yeah, I definitely worth checking out both of those adventures, especially the Demon Drums, if you haven't, if you like Crawljammer and haven't had a chance to explore that.
Deep cut on that.
What about you, Bob?
So I got into like a frame of mind. I'm looking at everything that I noted here. I'm like, yeah, I was kind of in a place. Pax Lexquer from Reorgan Games, which is Ed Stanek. Mm-hmm. Just something about the our first society sort of felt imperial in kind of a Roman sort of way, right? We have this absolute ruler who can say whether you live or die, and there's his daughter who you can't even speak to till she's 20, and they wear togas with G-strings. And all this kind of wrapped into my brain. I thought it would be really easy to kind of reskin Romans. And so when I started looking further into that, one of Ed Stanek's books is The Hand of the Law, and it's a trio of adventures. And the first one is On His Majesty's Secret Service, and it's going out and hunting for lost sheep. Like, okay, so that's sort of going out and hunting. You easily set that among the trees, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then there's just kind of more things develop as you go. There's the second adventure is All in the Family, and it's, you know, finding a thief of magical supplies. And I'm thinking, well, it's sort of like hunting down maybe the last member of one of the raiding parties who have been, you know, one of the Thorist raiding parties that have been coming up the trees. So there was kind of this feel with The Hand of the Law, and then the final one from that line that sprang to my mind was "We Who Are About to Die," which is, you know, a gladiatorial arena. It sort of had a feel for me of the decay. Now we're kind of in the thorist portion of things, where things are more barbaric and bestial and things of that nature. So all of that Ed Stanek goodness sort of sprang to my mind. And then while I was kind of keeping that theme in my brain, I realized that Caverns of Thracia by Janelle Jacquez would be perfect, because if you change the caverns, you know, and passages to branches and tree trunks with all of the ways up and down, you know, sequoia-sized trees as opposed to caverns, and it would work just fine. You could use, you know, the beastmen as the thorists who overthrew the kingdom long ago and are now in decay and decline. It would be, I think, a near perfect reskin. And it's a great adventure. I know a lot about Caverns of Thracia. It's a great adventure. But that's what I had for reskins this time around.
Very cool. Well, I think that brings us to our DCC feature for the show. And since I got to pick this one, it was along the themes of what I was thinking about with Mutant Crawl Classics. This is MCC number 12, When Manimals Attack, by Tim Snyder.
The rescue of a feral manimal child leads to an amazing discovery. She hails from the fabled lands of Zoo itself. But when manimal enforcers attack your village and retrieve the child, your seeker team must locate the legendary city to rescue her.
Yeah, this is a fun one. You know, I have never played in it, but I, you know, got to read it and enjoy it. The main thing for me was, you know, there's obviously the parallels between this, you know, very small enclave in the tribes of Zoo, as you say, Bob, I love that pronunciation, and the Thoris, right? Because there is a leader who, you know, basically said, I want to become, I want to have this genetic modifications, and I'm going to, you know, attract all these followers and sort of lead this kind of revolution, with these believers. And, you know, I think you could, you know, there's some parallels there with, you know, the story that's on the Pirates of Venus. But it's also just a fun setting, you know, to have this sort of very MCC to have it like in an old zoo, you know, where everything is sort of now reskinned and reappropriated, you know, for the MCC world. And this is one of those that's it's tongue in cheek, but just enough tongue in cheek to make it very fun for the players, I think.
And for our listeners, that is Z U U for the
song. Right, that's what I said. Zoo.
Zoo. And I hadn't actually read a lot of Tim Snyder's work, and I know he's done a couple of MCC modules, so I'm eager to check the other ones out as well.
Oh yeah,
it's a fun one, and some MCC adventures are more MCC than others, if that makes sense. Some more closely kind of stick to the book, others kind of stray off into cartoon land, and Tim really knows how to pull the most out of the MCC setting. Mm-hmm. And he does it really well. The entire adventure is very like Island of Dr. Moreau. And when you get to Zoo, all the different habitats certainly could be used to represent different areas of Amtor, you know, in the trees, on the ground, things like that. I love any adventure that lets you punish PCs by giving them exactly what they want. Which this does. And actually... Oh yeah, the end of the adventure. You know, punish the players by giving them what they want.
And you then, sure you want to try this device out after?
Yeah, right.
Oh, after seeing what the consequences of it are. Yeah.
Be a manimal? And you're right. The zoo setting is a really good MCC setting. This is like one of two adventures I've seen that use it. The other is, I want to say, Night of the Space Apes by Charles Vizor in Scientific Barbarian. It uses a very different tack. So this really, really fits nicely, I think, for what we're discussing, but also it's a nice, tight, you know, adventure. What do you think, Jen?
I saw some definite similarities between the child to be rescued and the Princess of Amphor. But I'm always stuck on this one. I'm stuck on the cover because it's one of the last pieces that Ken Kelly did.
Yeah, and it's a really, really nice cover.
Yeah, it's very distinct from a lot of the other things in the Goodman Games line, too, just to see it. So,
yeah, every once in a while, you'll see a cover that stands out is different. Like, I think the 5th edition Fantasy Adventure, is it the three wizard problem?
Conundrum.
Yes, by Mihaly Lunacek. That one, I mean, the cover is absolutely gorgeous. It really sticks out. And yeah, when Manimals Attack, very dark, evocative cover. It kind of reminiscent of like a 70s movie poster, really.
I did say Ken Kelly.
That's fair.
Well, have we covered everything that we want to cover for Pirates of Venus?
I think so.
Well then, what will we be reading next month? A work praised as a pioneering variation on the parallel worlds theme, The Heads of Cerberus by Gertrude Barrows Bennett. Jen, do you want to take this one on?
I am so looking forward to this one. We did the Citadel of Fear in the Sanctum Sacrum reading room a year or two ago, and it was absolutely fantastic. I'll get into a whole lot more next month on that one. But suffice to say, Lovecraft was a fan of hers. So I'm all in. On the horizon from Sanctum Media are not one, but two new patrons from Ugandan author Ashraf Braden. Look for the first of these, Luboa, in the coming weeks. And the most recent release is currently up on DriveThruRPG.
All right. Well, if you're enjoying the show, please comment on the podcast or help us by posting a review on iTunes or YouTube. Those ratings and review help new listeners find the podcast and our community. Well, I certainly enjoyed getting together with both of you to discuss this, even though I didn't enjoy the book as much as other books that we've covered, but the conversation is always enlightening and it's always fun to imagine this at our DCC table and how it inspires us. And I think it inspired us, each of us, in certain ways, so, which is good. And something completely different. Completely differently, yeah. But any last thoughts, Jen or Bob?
I'll take a brief moment and plug my Patreon, which is over at patreon.com/sanctummedia. I've taken the Dictionnaire Infernal, which is a 19th century French book on demonology, and I'm translating it to English and adding gameable content for each entry. And so I've been having a lot of fun with that. We've done 3 months so far. And the latest releases include a character class. So we have the apostate character class for clerics who have lost their faith. They're not just a warrior, right? Because they weren't a warrior to begin with. They're something else. But every paid level from $1 to $8 gets content every month, whether it's a demon for the month, the 13 entries for the month, and then at the $8 level, you also get to vote on one of the entries to expand and have additional content for. So I've been having a lot of fun with that so far. So plug, plug, plug. That's my plug.
Yay, shameless plugs. And yet, we're still going to get more Skull and Crossbones classics, right, Bob?
Yes, we are. Yes, we are. I've got apparently, I have to restock the Goodman store with issue one, which is all the more reason to get issues two and three finished up. Two is the Seafaring issue, three is the Shantyman character class issue. And both of those are near done. And then I've just been hit with project after project after project. So. It's hard to say no when Michael Curtis says, hey, Bob, would you like to do, I don't know, Caverns of Thracia?
As for last thoughts, I would say it was wonderful to see everyone at GaryCon, but next time Patient Zero can stay home.
Oh, yeah, I think we're going to go back to wearing a mask.
Oh, gosh.
Yes.
This year was especially bad with post-con crud, I think, for a lot of people. So,
still not 100% myself. Yeah. But it was nice to see everybody. Got to meet some other really nice people. Got to play in a game of Star Crawl, which was a lot of fun.
Well, we'll wrap up. And there you have it. Thank you all so much for listening. And it's been a lot of fun talking about another Burroughs book. Until next time, I've been Keeper Mark.
I'm Keeper Bob.
And Keeper Jen.
Thanks all, and good night.
You have been listening to the Sanctum Sacrorum podcast. The Sanctum Sacrorum Podcast has been a production of Sanctum Media.